Coming up, your regularly scheduled podcast. But first, a brief introduction by myself, Maki Yamazaki. A room full of disembodied, living heads. A key that decides when it is time for you to think. Ham sandwiches. A dream? You may be an adult now, but are you still scared?
Hi, Adam.
Hi, I finished coughing.
Oh, well done.
So, thanks. Thank you. I'm ready to pod.
Oh, yeah. So, I couldn't remember if it was you who introduced me to Return to Oz.
Well, I...
Was it?
It could have been. I certainly got into it. I didn't watch it as a kid. As I've said on previous weeks, there's no way, you know, like, I would have bailed early on this one. And to be fair, the first 20 minutes of Return to Oz are basically... like Wuthering Heights or something. It just seems to be like some desolate gothic.
Yep.
So, you know, understandably so, I think. But no, I discovered it. I can't remember who introduced me to it, though. It's one of those sort of films that I can imagine just sort of spreads via whispers down dark alleyways. You know, you're just sort of walking down a street, someone says, "Have you seen Return to Oz?" You know? It's in the kids' VHS section. It's not really a kids' film, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I only saw it probably around the same time you did, if not a little before, like sometime in my early to mid-20s. So how did you feel the first time you watched it?
I loved it. I don't know. I didn't grow up with The Wizard of Oz. I'd maybe seen it once. I think maybe Return to Oz is uncomfortable for people who have fond associations with The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, yeah. I think a lot of Return to Oz is about the fact that it's not The Wizard of Oz and you're not going to get The Wizard of Oz and you can't return to The Wizard of Oz. So, yeah, I think if you're someone who grew up with The Wizard of Oz as a kind of perennial children's favourite, it would be particularly distressing because my understanding is... people who loved The Wizard of Oz, and I know Roger Ebert loved The Wizard of Oz, and I listened to his review and he hated it. But people who like the books actually quite like it.
It's, much more in the spirit of the books than...
I absolutely agree. So why would you say that? Sorry, this is me going into total like lecturer mode. This is what I'm like with my students. they'll say something kind of loose, right? And then I'm like, okay, well, define exactly. Like, I was doing this today with them talking about Adam Curtis documentaries. You know, like they're like, oh, well, the music choices are a bit strange. Like, strange how? No, I don't know. Kind of strange. In what way?
Yeah, sorry.
I don't know. Leave me be.
The feeling of a kind of... I mean, it's a lot less heartwarming than the delightful adventures of The Wizard of Oz. It's more just a series of unusual places and people that happen without really any overarching meaning to them necessarily.
Yeah, it's definitely one thing after another. Whereas I guess, I mean, the original MGM musical is like that, but I guess the way musicals work is they have these song and dance numbers which sort of hold the whole thing together. So they feel more coherent than they actually are, almost.
Yeah.
But my sister said, so I didn't think I'd get Phoebe to watch any of this, to be honest, because she really hates certain analogue special effects, but like old puppets and that kind of thing. Like, she does not, you know, I love this kind of stuff, but my sister really doesn't. And she didn't like The Wizard of Oz when she was a kid and found it scary. And I'd shown her the front cover of the DVD, which is probably more troubling than the film itself in many ways. I don't know, like, on my, you've got this sort of slightly, I don't know, it's very odd, this kind of slightly glossy looking drawing or maybe painting of the characters, and everyone sort of looks like they're kind of made of porcelain or something, like, especially Dorothy on the front, she looks kind of like one of those Toby jugs.
Okay, yeah.
It looks like they've all got a sort of eggshell finish. But anyway, I didn't think she'd like it. But actually, she kind of got into it and said she much preferred it to The Wizard of Oz. And her main reason, which I thought was quite a good observation, was that she said she found Dorothy a lot more relatable and she found the characters much easier to get along with. So she said, well, in the original, she felt that all the characters were always literally having to make a song and dance of things. She felt that they were always trying to entertain her, basically, as a viewer. And she said she didn't like it. It felt kind of try-hard. And I guess as a cynical 90s kid, like, you know, she would feel like that, that there's a certain sense of, let's escape the Great Depression with enforced happiness, everyone, in the original Wizard of Oz. And I think, I don't know if it's partly knowledge about the production after the fact, but she said she doesn't like the original Dorothy because it seemed like she was just pretending to be happy. And, I mean, obviously, we know that Judy Garland was very much pretending to be happy. It was a really miserable filming experience, you know, it's...
This might be a good point to give a little summary. So, Return to Oz is set 6 months after The Wizard of Oz, and we come back to Kansas and everything is not going very well at all. Obviously, the house got destroyed in the hurricane and... Uncle Henry is in kind of a funk and he isn't, like, building the new house as fast as he should be, and Aunt Em can't cope with all the farm chores, and Dorothy can't sleep and she keeps telling people her stories of Oz and they don't believe her, and, like, even Bellina the chicken isn't laying eggs and is being threatened with being cooked up. So it's a fairly bleak setup. And they're unable to work out what to do with Dorothy, so they take her to a doctor for electric healing.
What you need is a little electric healing.
Yeah.
My sister made a very mortified face at that line, I remember.
Yeah. And sort of as Dorothy and Aunt Em leave the farm to go to the city to see this doctor, Toto doesn't come with them and he kind of howls mournfully at this misty field, and it's just like, it's pretty grim.
Although, as my sister cheerfully pointed out, the real Toto would be long dead, so it's a fake Toto anyway.
It's just a replacement Toto. It's fine. So
Dorothy's taken off to this very kind of gothic looking Victorian style hospital.
Yeah.
And the sort of superciliously friendly avuncular doctor talks very patronisingly to Dorothy and says, I know just the thing to cheer.
Oh, God, he's the Gnome King, isn't he?
Yeah. He's the same guy who...
Sorry. just got that. Yes.
Yeah, the outer world mirrors the inner world of Oz. was it because of my Gnome King voice?
It's because you said avuncular, and I'd been thinking about how the Gnome King had this avuncular... but sinister manner.
He does! Yeah, it's funny because, you know, many uncles must also be fathers, but, you know, there are uncly uncles. It's a specific type, isn't it? Like, can you imagine having an uncle for a father?
Well...
Yeah, that's not the thing. So, anyway, he says, I know just the thing to cheer Dorothy up. Electrocution, it turns out to be. And his EST machine has a face which he delights in showing Dorothy. And of course, we talked about how so he ends up becoming the Gnome King in Oz, and the electric shock therapy machine becomes TikTok, Dorothy's loyal soldier friend. So it's nice that even the electric shock therapy machine gets its own starring role in The Land of Oz too.
So there's a number of quite ghoulish touches when Dorothy is at the hospital. I particularly enjoyed Dorothy retelling the like macabre story of the Tin Man to to the doctor and Aunt Em, who's sitting there looking like ashen-faced. And this is like pretty much kind of verbatim from the, you know, the book The Wizard of Oz. It's like, and then he accidentally chopped off his right leg, and then he replaced it with a tin leg, and then he accidentally chopped off his other leg, and then he replaced that with a tin leg.
I think it's very good in that it kind of recasts the events of The Wizard of Oz in a troubling new light, I think, I imagine, to a lot of viewers, because, you know, it's like that stuff was there in the original, but I guess because the MGM musical's so happy and bright, like, you wouldn't think, hang on a minute, that's pretty worrying.
Yeah, so I thought that was pretty good.
Weirdly, this whole framing narrative of the character coming back from, you know, a fantastical world and then no one believing them and then being diagnosed as being mentally unwell was copied seemingly verbatim by American McGee for his early 2000s edgelord goth fest American McGee's Alice, which was his 18 rated form. Did you play it or you?
No, but I think I've heard you talk about it.
we're just like, oh, imagine if Alice from Alice in Wonderland actually was like just crazy and all this stuff like was products of her twisted mind, but maybe it was real, you know, like. And I kind of find it funny that, you know, Walt Disney came up with, well, not Walt Disney himself clearly, yeah, unless the dead Walt Disney from beyond the grave, but Disney had released a film 2 decades earlier with exactly this plot line. So edgy enough for an 18 rated game and edgy enough for a PG rated kids film.
Yep. So Dorothy spends the night in this little like cell like room and is like peeling paint on the walls and a tiny window, and it's raining outside and she can hear the screams of other patients and so on.
Who we are informed are locked in the basement.
Yes, and they were damaged and they were locked in the basement. We get informed, hopefully.
Just in case the kids thought everything was okay.
Yes.
Just in case they thought the screaming was just a normal part of the treatment.
Yeah. And then the nurse, the very, very austere, terrifying nurse who becomes Princess Mombi, comes to take Dorothy to her treatment, and she has to lay down on the gurney and be strapped down. She's taken to the machine, and it's about to be turned on, and then there's a power cut.
Right.
I suddenly had this realization while watching this that it reminded me very much of Brazil.
That's really interesting, because I totally thought of Brazil, and I thought, oh, I might bring up Brazil because I know it's one of Ren's favourite films, and then I was like, it's a bit of a tangent, so I don't think I will. So I'm really glad you said that, because I also thought, it's kind of like grubby steampunk in the way that Brazil is.
Yeah, and it is a bit of a tangent, but I kind of want to go into it because Brazil is one of my favourite films.
okay, sure, I'm interested in where this is going.
Okay. Also released in 1985, by the way, directed by Terry Gilliam. In that film, the main character, Sam Lowry, is a low-level bureaucrat in a sort of 1984-esque dystopia who escapes reality through sort of fantastical romantic daydreams. And at the end, he's arrested and is strapped to a chair in the depths of an old power station. and he's about to be tortured by his old friend, Jack. And Jack's sort of coming towards him, and just then, these rescuers abseil down the walls of the power plant. They kill Jack, they escape with Sam, and he runs away to the country to live in an idyllic cottage with the woman he loves. until actually then it's revealed that this was just another fantasy, and the film ends with him still strapped into this chair, and he's entirely lost connection with reality.
No, it doesn't, Ren. The American version is canon, my friend.
Oh, yes. Oh, no, I'm sorry. He runs away to live in the idyllic cottage with the woman he loves, and then the theme tune plays.
Yeah. And then Terry Gilliam had the audacity to change it. Like a fool.
So
are you trying to suggest that maybe this ever-so-convenient power cut and was all a little bit too convenient?
It's just a little bit too convenient. You know, there's a power cut, and then there's this mysterious little girl, and she leads Dorothy by the hand, and they escape, and they go to the river, and then they get washed away.
And the little girl drowns in the river.
The little girl drowns, yeah.
I mean, we hear at the end of the film that everyone apart from the doctor, who dies trying to rescue his beloved ECT machine friend, survived. But the way it's phrased suggests it's everyone who was in the building survived. And the mysterious unnamed little girl wasn't in the building. The last time, you know, we see her is struggling in the river. So it is left quite disturbingly open, I think, as to whether she does drown. So I think it's unfair to say, in fact, that the Dorothy has nothing when she's left in the cell. Because Ozma first turns up when she's in the cell, she sort of suddenly appears there, the door's locked, and yet this little girl is suddenly magically in the room, and she gives her a little pumpkin, right? Yeah. And then Dorothy, you know, she doesn't have much to do, but she does find a way to occupy herself. She combs the imaginary hair of the pumpkin.
She does!
Which I thought was very charming.
Yeah.
I think if you're locked away in a gothic Victorian hospital, combing the imaginary hair of a pumpkin is definitely a good way to occupy your time.
It was a good touch. Yeah.
Sweet.
It's Fairuza Balk playing Dorothy.
So anyway, they go to the stream.
And washed away, Dorothy manages to clamber onto a piece of wood. The other girl presumably drowns. We don't know. And then when Dorothy wakes up, she's in the deadly desert in Oz, and she has Billina, the chicken, with her.
Who can talk, Billina, although
Who can talk?
Toto never talked, right?
I don't think,
I'm fairly certain, I'm 85%.
I'm fairly sure.
Toto. To be fair, I've watched The Wizard of Oz in the last 2 years, and so I really should remember.
Okay.
And unless I've repressed some kind of, like, Toto voice from my head, like, hey, Dorothy, let's keep on going down that road, or something. But I don't think that happened, so...
No. In the book, The Marvelous Land of Oz, when Billina talks, she says that her name is Bill, and Dorothy finds that insufficiently feminine and calls her Billina. But we don't get that backstory in the film.
Which is a shame, because there's a lovely bit in the third book, I think, where we meet Linda again, and she ends up being kind of put in a chicken coop, basically. And within just a day of being away from Ozma and Dorothy, she has reverted to calling herself Bill and acting like a chicken and getting into fights, basically. And Dorothy's quite annoyed and upset by this.
Yeah.
And basically, like, either Dorothy or Ozma is like, oh, girl, look at you, you know, you've got a half an eye out and, you know, you've got blood on you and you have feathers all over it. And, Bill goes, "Oh, you should see the other one."
Yeah.
Come on then.
So maybe we should call her Bill, as that is her preferred name.
Yeah, I'm fine with calling her Bill. Did you want to talk briefly about the sort of gender play in the books?
Oh yeah, shall we?
Yeah, I think we can digress on our path through the plot of Return to Oz with a digression.
Okay, it's great. Okay, so basically in the marvelous land of Oz, the character that we're introduced to is a boy called Tip, who is under the kind of guardianship of the old witch Mombi, and is put to work by her. So this is a slightly a different iteration of Mombi than in Return to Oz. And there's a pretty delightful twist at the end of the book, where it turns out that this character, Tip, has been Princess Ozma all along, enchanted by Mombi to be a boy. And all the sort of gang of misfits reassure Tip that they will like him just as much when he's a girl. And then I've drawn this quote out because it was great. When he's transformed back into Ozma, he says, "I hope none of you will care less for me than you did before. I'm just the same Tip, you know. Only you're different," said the Pumpkinhead. And everyone thought that it was the wisest speech he had ever made. And I just cannot not, like, read that as an affirming trans narrative. I'm just incapable of not seeing it like that. So it won my heart.
It was definitely something that was really charming about the books, that as with Bill the Chicken or Hen, it seems like it's very on side with the idea that identities are inherently unstable and in states of flux, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. And we should kind of have, you know, a on the moment kind of DIY kind of approach to things.
Mm-hmm.
Like one thing that one of the reviews said negatively about Return to Oz, which I really disagree with, is they said this band of misfits or something like that, and in a sort of derogatory way, you know, are too weird for kids to like, and they're weird enough that you can't tell them apart from the bad guys. Whereas, you know, in the original, and like that's what makes Return to Oz really charming. I think probably what is probably why it connected with a lot of odd outcast kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is because all these characters are kind of making up their identities as they go along and doing their best of it, and that it's got this. I think that the villains, right, in the Oz books, and this comes across in Return to Oz a bit, are those who insist too strongly on the stability of identity, basically. It tends to be those who kind of get obsessed with certain status symbols,
for instance. Right, so, like, you're only a scarecrow, you can't possibly do that.
Yeah, exactly. Or, say, the Gnome King gets very caught up on these quite labyrinthine arguments about why it's okay for him to turn people into objects, basically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's quite patently immoral to turn people into objects.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he manages to kind of almost convince himself, because, you know, he's a king and it's okay for him to do this, and otherwise they'd be slaves and, well, they're happier as objects. And most of the kind of villainous characters basically speak from authority but don't have any actual way of backing up what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, the heroes tend to, I guess, speak from a place of love and compassion, and, like, all the heroes are oddly, I don't want to say, they are kind of, like, pragmatist in the kind of William Jamesian American pragmatist way, that their philosophies are basically based on what's needed in the moment, and to approach these things with, a swing in their step and an honourable smile and, you know, like decency, basically. Like, resilience and decency are essentially two traits, and not taking yourself too seriously, I guess.
Yes, and I think the Gump is quite representative of that. He just kind of has this kind of
So how do you explain the Gump for those who haven't seen Return to Oz or read the books?
Yes. So the Gump is a creature who is made in a hurry to escape different situations in the book and the film, but anyway, to escape, who is made of a couple of sofas pushed together and tied together, and some palm leaves for wings, and then the head of a creature called a Gump, which is a sort of antlered beast.
It's a moose-like creature.
A kind of moose-like thing, and these are all hastily tied together, and then with the powder of life sprinkled on top to become a kind of creature. And the Gump is just sort of very, like, amiably confused by existence and by being this Gump that he is now, having last year remembered being a moose-like creature running through a forest. But it's kind of accepting of this turn of fate and just sort of gets on with it.
Yeah, it's sort of like when they ask the Gump to fly. It's like, well, I haven't done it before, but hey, yeah, you know, I'll give it a go.
Yeah.
It actually reminded me a bit of the, less tragically, at least, of the whale in Hitchhikers.
Yes.
So in Hitchhikers, yeah, it's, the infinite improbability drive creates a whale just in space out of nothing, and it spends most of its short existence as it plummets towards an Earth, just sort of bemusedly remarking on how curious it is to be alive and trying to name things around.
Yeah, I feel like Douglas Adams probably read these books. I don't know, I have no proof of that.
They do have a kind of Douglas Adamsy sense of humour. Like, yeah, I found them a lot funnier than I was expecting.
Yeah. The bit that that also reminded me of Douglas Adams was the character of the Hungry Tiger in Oz
the Robot. I really like that Hungry Tiger.
The Hungry Tiger's great.
Have you got the whole eating babies bit?
I do, have it here, yes. So, he's a character who's constantly at war between his hunger and his conscience. And
aren't we all?
And the Gnome King, this is at the sort of final part of the book, and the Gnome King's like, "What more do you want?" to the Hungry Tiger, and the Hungry Tiger says, "A fat baby. I want a fat baby. A nice, plump, juicy, tender, fat baby. But of course, if I had one, my conscience would not allow me to eat it, so I'll have to be an ornament and forget my hunger."
And then you get stuff about this sort of the unfair assumptions that come with stable identities, right? Because Dorothy says to the Hungry Tiger, "Oh, it seems like you're a very good tiger." And he says, "Oh, no, I'm not a very good tiger. If I was a good tiger, I'd be eating the babies, because that's what's expected of a tiger. I'm actually a very bad tiger." Yeah, so you have a lot of these characters are often kind of forced to fit into a certain role, and they don't really do it, and so they kind of muddle along the best they can, and that's all really charming, and like, I do think that's something that Return to Oz still manages to preserve. Like, I really like how damn rickety Jack Pumpkinhead looks, for instance.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I find it a little bit disturbing how the sticks of his knees are broken and, like, barely connected together, but it is a good effect. Like, he looks incredibly ramshackle.
Yeah, he really does look sort of jumbled together, and they do this odd, I don't know if it's a sort of video effect, I spent quite a lot of the time in the film trying to work out how they did different special effects, and one thing I like that sort of suits this DIY approach is that, you know, it has bits of stop motion in there, apparently courtesy of Will Vinton, famous American stop motion animator. Mm-hmm. You know, it has blue screening bits, it has some kind of video editing trickery going on, I think. It just sort of throws, like, loads of different special effects at the screen and, you know, hopes for the best, basically.
It looks great, though.
Which, yeah, it does. It, I mean, it was directed by Walter Murch, who apparently worked on a lot of Francis Ford Coppola's films in the 70s. So he's had a sort of prestige career. So he did the sound design for The Conversation, for instance, with Gene Hackman. And he also did the director's cut re-edit of Apocalypse Now. So, so he's not coming from a traditional, the kind of background you'd expect for someone who's directing Return to Oz. You know, he's coming from, prestige isn't quite the right word, but, you know, the new American cinema of the 70s, which is generally known for ushering in an era of good cinematography and good lighting to American cinema. And I think that's all on display in Return to Oz. I really do think it looks very good. Like, especially the lighting, there's some great lighting in it. Especially with Mumbai, this witch, she has casements of heads, basically. So she switches out her heads to change, suit her identity. I mean, it mostly seems to be fairly fickle in her cases. It mostly seems to be based on how she wants to look. So there's a bit where they, Dorothy and friends have to sneak into a cupboard of heads. And the lighting in this scene is incredible. You've got this lovely low-key lighting with these great pools of darkness, and it's really sort of dark and expressionistic, and makes it all the scarier. And the costumes. Do you want to talk about the costumes? I mean, like the Wheelers.
Oh, the Wheelers. Well,
so in the original illustrations, the Wheelers just have, like, a spotty shirt on and a ruff.
Oh, okay. I haven't actually seen the illustrations because I was reading the Project Gutenberg download on my Kindle.
Well, if you look at the right Project Gutenberg download, you can see the pictures.
Yes.
With Gutenberg, you get, like, the different formats.
Okay. No, so I haven't seen any of the pictures, but they are described in Ozma of Oz as wearing... being clothed most gorgeously in embroidered garments of many colours and wearing straw hats perched jauntily on the side of their heads, and also as all clad in splendid tight-fitting garments. And then in the film they're kind of what are they? They're like Adam and the Ants.
They are like Adam and the Ants, actually.
Yeah.
Well, they're kind of like if a group of spider monkeys went to a junkyard and tried to set up an Adam and the Ants tribute band.
Yeah.
Sort of.
And they have these masks that they sort of flip down over their face or have on the top of their head, which were all connected with wires. And then they have, obviously, wheels on their, or at the end of all their limbs,
which are
incredibly long.
And apparently, according to the books, and obviously you don't get this in the film, made of kind of bone, basically.
That's what I was going to say, yeah. Yeah, I noticed that. Their wheels were of the same hard substance that our fingernails and toenails are composed of.
Which is great, just imagining your fingernails, like, curling round to make little wheels.
Yeah. And, so the Wheelers are, for people who did see Return to Oz.
So the Wheelers are the first antagonists, so... Dorothy, to get back onto the yellow brick road, finds herself in the deadly desert and basically plays a kid's game of lava to get to the end of the desert without stepping on the sand and turning horribly to sand. First comes across her first, and she sees a message saying beware. It's like graffitied, I think, in the film. It's written out on the or written in the sand in the book that says beware, beware the Wheelers.
Yeah.
And very soon after seeing this message, the Wheelers appear.
Yeah. And it's particularly horrible sounds when they appear. It's kind of these screeching wheels and cackling. And I was just reading an article on Den of Geek, I'll link to in the show notes, that points out that the sound of the Wheelers is the same as the sort of creaking hospital trolleys. As they trundle through the corridors. I'm like, oh.
Oh, that's really clever. Like,
yeah.
I didn't, yeah. You can, and you can imagine them being called colloquially wheelers, can't you? Like, oh, I'll get the wheeler for patient in block 6.
Yeah, and they chase Dorothy into a little room that she, which is where she finds TikTok.
So
who then beats them off? Yeah.
So TikTok's the sort of one man or one robot army of Oz.
Yes, who is controlled by clockwork, and he has three winches. One to control his action, one to control his talking, and one to control his thought. And they can all wind down at different times, so Dorothy has to keep winding him up in various ways.
It's really sad, like, the idea that, yeah, he's dependent. Especially, like, you know, there's a real horror in that, I think. The idea of his, you know, movements running down, but then his thoughts still going, and that he's dependent on someone else to solve this for him.
Yeah, I think Dorothy says, oh, why didn't they make it so you could wind yourself?
Yeah, she does, actually, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, he manages to beat off the wheelers with a lunch.
Yeah, with a pail about the head.
And then the next antagonist is Princess Mumbi. Of the many heads, who is a kind of amalgamation of two characters from The Marvelous Land of Oz and Ozma of Oz. So there's the old witch Mumbi in The Marvelous Land of Oz, who seems to basically have the personality of Princess Mumbi in the film, like, very malevolent. And then there's the character Princess Langwider in Ozma of Oz, who is the character who wants to take Dorothy's head and who has a collection of heads. Although she's rather more scatterbrained and just sort of vain rather than actively evil.
Yeah, she's quite easily placated and doesn't seem to really wish Dorothy any real harm. Well, she does want to take her head off, but apart from that...
She was going to give her another one.
Yeah, that's true. She was going to give her... It's not like she was going to leave her with no head. She's not a monster. She was, to be fair to her, going to chop her head off and replace it with an old head she didn't want anymore.
Yes.
But Dorothy obviously is quite particular about having her own head, and so refuses this. And so this is where in Return to Oz she meets Jack Pumpkinhead up in the kind of attic or the top story of Mumbi's castle, and then together they make the gump.
Yes.
And then it's really just sort of on to the Gnome King, really. Like,
yeah.
I think the thing I say I really like Return to Oz, but it has a very long beginning and a very long end.
Yeah.
So there's not all that much incident once she sort of met the characters, basically. You know, once the central party have got together, it's off on the back of the gump to get to the Gnome King's rocky palace.
Yep.
They have a bit of, misadventure on the way there, don't they? Because the gump kind of falls apart or something?
Oh, yes, and it seems like they might land in the Deadly Desert for a moment, but they don't. But yeah, it's fairly just like one thing after another. One antagonist after another.
Yeah. Although, you know, it works, I think, because...
Yeah,
like,
I think it does.
That's kind of what you want in a way in a kid's film. Like, yeah. It certainly... There's no real downtime. You know, there's always something happening and something to catch your attention.
Yeah. The Gnome King is, as we sort of mentioned earlier, he's an interesting villain because he's a very avuncular and... he in the book, he keeps talking about how he's extremely kind and merciful while actually being very cruel and calculating.
He's very good at justifying or seeming to justify his cruelties, right, using kind of legalistic language.
Yeah.
Like, one thing I kind of liked about the Oz books is you get the sense that Balm is very much someone who's on side with the spirit of the law rather than the letter of the law.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, generally, if he feels the characters are being kind and decent, well, you know, let them go on with it. Where, say, the Gnome King, who is able to kind of, because he's king, of course, and so has the power to write the laws, and so is very able to back up all this cruelty legalistically, but he's obviously not acting out of any compassion or genuine kindness. So
the Gnome King has transformed the Scarecrow into an ornament, and he gives the assembled crew a certain number of guesses to go in and guess which ornament is the Scarecrow. And if they get it right, they can leave with the Scarecrow, and if not, then they also get turned into an ornament. Which is again bringing up this this theme of a sort of fluidity between people and objects, and what is consciousness, and
what does it mean to be a being with agency and to be afforded that right, almost.
There's also in the film all the inhabitants of the Emerald City have been turned into statues.
In a scene very reminiscent, because this isn't in the book, to my knowledge, not the two we've read. And it seemed very reminiscent of Narnia to me.
It was extremely Narnia, yeah. There was even a lion.
Yeah. Although, luckily, Dorothy's too decent to draw a comedy moustache on the stone lion. Unlike that Edmund.
Edmund.
Don't worry, he's reformed. He's not as bad as Susan. I heard she likes parties.
Oh, Susan. I heard she owns a fur coat and it doesn't go down to her ankles.
Yeah, and, well, we know that all her siblings are going to die and she's not going to go to heaven, so... I don't know why I'm imagining C.S. Lewis as being so catty, but, you know, that's probably how I'm picturing him. But basically, you know, I grew up with the Narnia books, and I kind of wish now I'd grown up with the Oz books, because I think there's a lot more human warmth and kindness and decency in the Oz books than there ever were in the Narnia books, frankly.
Yeah, I do. I feel like it's a shame that they're not so much read anymore, because I think they definitely hold up.
Yeah, really charming. Like, I don't know if it's that the musical so kind of overtook the fame and popularity of the books, or that they're kind of lumped in with late Victorian era kids' literature. Like, it's very different from, the Water Babies is a bit earlier, and you'll probably end up doing the Water Babies on a different podcast, I imagine. That's all sorts of horrible. But doesn't have that kind of school teacherly hectoring tone that, say, the Water Babies has. It's just really nice, like, which is funny to say something like, because it's quite morbid and melancholy in its way, and there's lots of horrible stuff, but there's something really good, genuinely good natured about them that I found really charming.
I heard you just got the complete collection now. Aww. So I'm going to read more of them.
Cool. Yeah, I know Patchwork Girl of Oz is meant to be one of the best ones of the series, because I know it was made in part into a hypertext game.
Yes.
Like combining it, Shelley Jackson combining it with bits from Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Cool.
Really good. I wasn't sure if you were going to say anything about the reappearance of the ruby slippers.
Oh, Yeah, I didn't know quite what to do with that.
No, neither did I. Because it seems like it's the only gender play you get in the film, which is a shame because the gender play is very refreshing in the books. And for a very old book now, you know, it's really well done, I think. And it's a bit creepy, or made to be a bit creepy in the film. And
yeah, it doesn't have the same sort of matter-of-fact acceptance. It's more sort of a bit more just, oh, he's wearing these feminine shoes. It's the Gnome King.
Yeah, and it's done in this sort of odd way that his feet are kind of veiled, right? So they're kind of hidden by, I don't know if it's part of his costume or the throne, and then he kind of wiggles them out, right? So he kind of, you know, shows the shoes, like, ho, 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 I'm wearing the shoes, and then he sort of wiggles them back and hides them again. And he keeps sort of, like a tongue, he sort of pokes them out. But I don't know, it's done in this sort of weirdly, I don't want to say, not exactly lascivious kind of way, but
yeah,
sort of. It's, I don't know, it's very odd, and like, I don't quite know what they were trying to do with it.
No, me neither. Yeah, and as you say, it's a shame that that's sort of the only kind of gender play that we get.
Yeah, so, I mean, the film definitely adapts a lot more from Ozma of Oz than the second book. So we only meet Ozma as Ozma. Yeah. You know, we don't know that Ozma has lived out a large part of her life as Tip, for instance. So, yeah, I guess we don't get any of that, which I'm not sure. I think generally the film does quite a good job of taking the best bits from the two books.
Yeah.
But, it was a shame to miss that.
Yeah.
And then things sort of end, right? Like.
Yeah. so we have the bizarre the bizarre defeat of the Gnome King, in which we find out that Gnome Kings are allergic to eggs.
Which, to be fair, is in the book.
Yes, it's not any less odd in the book.
that perhaps was the one thing maybe they shouldn't have kept from the book. Because it almost feels like, you know, and you know, maybe it was just like anti-comedy, like 100 years too early. You know, this is the kind of thing Tim and Eric would have done. So kind of feels like a joke without a punchline.
Yeah.
But, you know, like the Amando Iannucci joke, what's big and small at the same time? A big egg.
Yeah.
Like, I guess we all know and appreciate that eggs are inherently funny, so.
Yes, they are. And also in the book, Dorothy just turns lots of the Gnome King's warriors into eggs, and they just roll along the floor.
That's a shame they didn't do that, actually. That was quite good. And then I like the fact that, you know, the warriors are clearly quite decent, and so they stop because they're like, oh my god, I don't want to step on, you know, my comrades who have now turned into eggs.
Yeah. She doesn't turn them back either, they're just eggs now.
But you know, maybe yeah. Being an egg, I'd rather be an egg than an ornament.
Yeah, actually you could hatch maybe.
Yeah, although what would you hatch another egg? in infinitely forever. A series of infinitely nesting hatching eggs.
Yeah.
What a life. Better than the life of poor Jack Pumpkinhead. So in the books, there's a fair amount of poor Jack kind of laments that as his head's a pumpkin, it's probably going to spoil after a couple of weeks, and so he's not going to live very long. And everyone else kind of gives him the brush off about this, I felt.
Yeah, they are not particularly concerned with his plight.
I mean, consider they're normally quite a compassionate bunch, really, but they have a bit of a blind spot when it comes to Pumpkinhead people, apparently. Cause
I mean, I think maybe Tip says that he'll can Jack's head before he spoils, but I don't know if that's really.
Yeah, and I don't think the idea is that his consciousness will be preserved in the can. I think it's like It's like for posterity, it's kind of like saying, I don't worry, yeah. I'll give you a really nice gravestone, so don't sweat the fact that you're really ill, you know?
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem to reassure Jack any. He seems to be quite, doesn't like the idea. But I did find it quite tragic, really, the genuine pathos in the fact that in the book, and this doesn't happen at all in the film, in the second Oz book, there's a point where there's a they've got this box filled with powder of life, which is what's used to bring Jack to life. And it's got a hidden compartment, like a secret bottom, and underneath it are three pills, and they're wishing pills. You take one and then you make a wish, basically. And they find these, and so, you know, this is essentially like a genie's lamp. These can do anything, seemingly. And so when they find them, Jack says, oh, you know, I can make a wish to wish that my head won't spoil. And they're all like, oh, yeah, we could do that. You know, but maybe later, mate. Okay. And then they end up in like a giant nest being attacked by birds. And they're like, right, better use one of these pills to wish we were somewhere outside of this giant nest. Okay, fair enough. It's a present danger. And I sort of assumed, oh, well, what will happen at the end of the book is, you know, they'll have these pills, and then Tip, because he's Jack's friend, will use one of the pills to, you know, to give Jack a different head, or to give him, you know, like a non-mouldy pumpkin head, something. And no, it just turns out that the Scarecrow loses the pills. So like, oh, do you have any more? And he's like, oh, God, you know what, mate? I think I just, like, left them in the nest. You know those pills that were, like, the most powerful thing in the entire universe and could do anything? Just left them in a nest. Sorry. And instead of, like, getting upset, everyone's just like, oh, oh yeah, there you go. Too late to worry about it now. And so, like, that's it. Jack doesn't get to live for any more than, like, a week or a month or however long it is, because the Scarecrow lost the pills.
Yep.
Like, you know, I think it's to Jack's credit he doesn't just throttle the Scarecrow right then, because like, if I was here, I would be pretty upset, to be honest. There's not all that much of the Scarecrow and the Tin Man in the second and third book, but there certainly isn't very much of them in Return to Oz. And one thing I imagine that a lot of viewers of the original might have found scary is that their faces look very different to the original faces.
They do. Even I noticed that, and I'm not very familiar with the originals, but I did think, ooh, they look a bit wrong.
But that's because they look much, much closer to the original drawings.
Oh, okay.
So they're quite clearly, I mean, obviously it's not an MGM film, so it's quite clearly perhaps making it obvious that these are based on the characters from the Barn books, which are owned at that point by Disney, right, and they had the rights to, rather than the MGM. So I do wonder if there was a slight legalistic aspect to it, as in, you know, no, you can't sue us because these aren't the same characters.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the Scarecrow, I think, looks a bit creepy because he's got this kind of funny, kind of gloopy, goopy, goofy, kind of watery face. I don't know, it looks like it's going to sort of run off his face at any point. like a sort of egg has been splatted on his face.
Yeah.
Pulled there in shape. But I don't know. The Tin Man looks pretty cool. The lion's a little bit creepy, but...
Definitely very shiny.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. The lion's a bit creepy, but we only see him for like 10 seconds, so it doesn't really matter. I mean, you know, it might have been a bit of a disappointment, I guess, for any kids who are, like, really looking forward to spending lots of time with their old friends, the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Lion, because they're not really... Considering they're on the front cover of the DVD.
Oh, are they?
Yeah. So my copy, it has Dorothy, say, with her strange Toby jug-like face, which I have... which is only the drawing, I must point out... Fairuza Bomb does not have a face like a Toby Jug.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, so on the front cover it's got her, and then sort of Belinda is sort of tucked under her arm. And then we've got TikTok and Jack, but then right next to them, in, you know, taking up just as much of the space are the Lion, the Tin Man, and the Scarecrow. So it kind of suggests, and they're all on the yellow brick road.
Oh yeah,
and
which, by the way, is broken up when we encounter it.
Yeah, you really can't go home again.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it does suggest, I think, that the film is going to be rather more like The Wizard of Oz than it actually is. I mean, I guess personally, I enjoy it more than The Wizard of Oz. I mean, probably meant to be sacrilege to say. And, you know, they're doing very different things, to be fair.
Mm.
But I think why I like Return to Oz is it makes Oz into a very inhabitable world.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I like the fact that a lot of it takes place in this sort of slightly scrubby environments, or, you know, a slightly bleak-looking woodland, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And that it kind of gives an earthiness to the fantasy. For all the special effects, it feels quite earthbound for a fantasy film to me. I guess for me, I've often struggled with fantasy, particularly in film rather than reading, because, like, I sometimes just can't take it that seriously, or it doesn't feel like a real place to me.
Yeah.
Like, I do like the Lord of the Rings films, but there are times where it kind of just feels like I don't really believe in the world for some reason. I don't know, there are just times, maybe it's the use of CGI or something, but there are times where the world almost looks too perfect. You know, maybe New Zealand is just too perfect. maybe that's the issue. New Zealand looks too good to be true. And I'm too used to, like, sort of run-down English countryside or something. That's probably the
image. Maybe.
But basically, a lot of Return to Oz looks kind of dreary and run down, and being British, that suits me just fine.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, that's our
aesthetic.
Yeah, we love it. Well, no, we don't, but it's all we know.
Exactly. It's all we
can't believe in anything
exactly.
else.
Exactly, it's all we know when we're small-minded, masochistic people. So it's all we want to know.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to say about this curious film?
I don't think... I think we covered it all.
I mean, I don't...
I mean...
Yeah, I don't know if I've got across quite how odd it is. Because it really, really is quite an odd film.
So after the Gnome King, Ozma gets released from the mirror, and
Dorothy, there's a parade.
I'm a little bit vague about what actually... I did watch this recently.
Well, the end, it does finish fairly in a fairly perfunctory way, to be honest.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of a parade. We see we see the line for like 5 seconds. There's a bunch of people all in green, so they're obviously Emerald City people. And then Dorothy's like, right, better go, guys. And they kind of put up a bit of token resistance. You're like, don't go. But gives everyone a hug, and then off she goes. And then she's back by the riverbank.
And Toto's there, like, yapping away, and...
We get a great Toto point of view shot. We get Toto point of view through the undergrowth. It's brilliant. It's like something from Blair Witch, or like... It's like the camera going right down through the grass. It's great.
Yeah, and he finds Dorothy, and then Aunt Em wraps her in a blanket, and we see that the hospital's burned down, and we see the nurse being taken away in a wagon.
Well, the back of a police wagon.
Yeah, the back of a police wagon. And it's back to the farm, and Uncle Henry's working on the house again. And
although it does have a slightly melancholy note, right, because Dorothy sees Ozma in the mirror back in her bedroom, and she calls and says, Aunt Em! And then Aunt Em calls back up and says, yes, and then Ozma in the mirror sort of goes, shh, at Dorothy, and Dorothy says, oh, no, it's nothing. And she kind of tilts the mirror, and then when Aunt Em comes into Dorothy's bedroom, she just says, oh, don't tilt the mirror, Dorothy, or something like that, and, you know, go outside. And I don't know, it kind of felt to me that, you know, Dorothy's just learnt from her traumatic experiences that she must keep Oz to herself, that this...
Yeah.
That this world... got to keep this as a private space, right? That it's not something she can share with her family.
Yeah, and because otherwise it disrupts everything.
Yeah, and well, she's taken away to receive the electric shock therapy.
Yeah, and as I haven't read any of the further in the series, I don't know about Dorothy's continuing involvement with Oz. Scariest moment?
Oh gosh, scariest moment. Probably the screaming heads. So, what do you find scariest?
I mean, I think I have to go for the Wheelers, just because I did actually jump when the first Wheeler appears and like cackles over at Dorothy's face. But there's plenty of candidates.
Oh, yeah. I think I don't find the Wheelers scary because, as I mean, you know, TikTok's not very impressed by the Wheelers, right? And because they're so obviously like try hard. They're just like these sort of bratty punks. They're like, yeah, we're the Wheelers, you know. And you're just like, oh, shut up. Go away, the Wheelers.
Cool. So you can find us on Twitter at StillScaredPod, or email us at StillScaredPodcast@gmail.com. Our opening music is by Maki Yamazaki. Our ending music is by Joe Kelly, Itelshin, and our artwork is by Letty Wilson, and I'll put all their details, as usual, in the show notes. Do you have a sign-off for us, Adam?
Oh, I don't know. I feel like it should be some kind of egg-based pun, basically, because of the egg, or the egg humour. I'm just thinking of the big egg joke in my head again now.
Yeah. I mean, what's big and small at the same time?
A big egg. Eggamentary, my dear Watson. That'll do. Bye.
That'll do. See ya.
And in the words of these two great gentlemen, Bill and Egg, be excellent to each other.